Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. To Americans over the age of about 50, the Cuban Missile Crisis remains in memory as one of the most harrowing experiences of their lives.
President Kennedy will address the nation tonight on radio and television on a subject of the highest national urgency.
On October 22, 1962, President John F. Kennedy broadcast a special message to the nation from his office in the White House.
It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
For 5 days in October of 1962, the world seemed poised on the brink of nuclear extinction until the crisis broke.
I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere, and we hope around the world. God willing, that goal will be achieved.
The curtain goes up at the United Nations on what the world hopes is the final act in the drama that was the Cuban crisis.
Now, best-selling author Stephen Carter has written a historical novel based on the U.S. intelligence community's desperate efforts to determine whether the Soviets were in fact sending nuclear missiles to Cuba. Carter is a professor of law at Yale University and a highly respected commentator on ethics and religion, the black experience in America, and much more. And so when I sat down to talk with him, we discussed his new novel, Back Channel, but also touched on other important themes in his work.
Why did you decide to write about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
It's funny. Very often I tell interviewers that when I write novels, and I've written a lot of them now, I start with a character and then come up with a story. This is the first time I've done it the other way around. This novel had its genesis in two historical facts. One of the historical facts is that when the Cuban Missile Crisis arose, President Kennedy kept a very small group of advisors in the White House and ran these secret negotiations to try to resolve it. But in addition, behind the secret negotiations was an even more secret negotiation called the back channel through which the crisis was actually resolved that only three or four people in the White House knew about. That's one of the facts. The other fact, which was revealed in Robert Dallek's excellent biography of Kennedy that came out about 8 years ago, is that while Kennedy was in the White House, he had an affair with a 19-year-old college student. So my thought from those two facts, I couldn't get this out of my head, was what if he didn't have an affair with a 19-year-old college student? What if the affair with the college student was the cover for the back channel negotiations? It's how he managed, you might say, to sneak out of the White House and do various other things so that if anyone discovered the president was involved in something clandestine, they would think it was the affair rather than the negotiations. So I got that idea. I added some background for the woman. I changed her facts from real life. And also you add to that some thrills and some threats to her life, and you've got a novel.
She is Margot Jensen in your novel,
yes.
19-year-old African-American student who is dragged in to the essentially the spying operation in which the United States is trying to find out what the Russians are shipping to Cuba, correct?
When we first meet Margot, she's a sophomore at Cornell, majoring in political science with no bigger dream than going to law school. She certainly has no interest in, as you say, being dragged into the middle of what's going on in Cuba. She doesn't even know anything is going on in Cuba. One of the striking things about the Cuban Missile Crisis in real life is how long it took the U.S. government to decide that there were missiles being moved into Cuba. The operation went on for months before the Central Intelligence Agency was able to figure out there were actually missiles being moved into Cuba. As late as about a month before the missiles were discovered, the official National Intelligence Estimate informed the White House that there was very little chance that Khrushchev would ever try to put nuclear missiles in Cuba. And that National Intelligence Estimate was issued while he was trying to do that. So the image I try to present in my book is of a national security establishment frantically trying to find out what happened in Cuba. They get a cryptic message relayed by a chess player, Bobby Fischer, who I always wanted to put in a novel. And somehow, through a variety of circumstances, that cryptic message being relayed to Bobby Fischer leads them to drag Margot, who, for a variety of reasons, the only person who can do it, into a trip to Bulgaria, where she's supposed to find out what's actually going on.
There's a world chess tournament taking place in Bulgaria. Bobby Fischer is playing in the tournament, and Margot is sent to essentially accompany him, and allegedly because he is going to have a contact that will help clarify what the Russians are sending. We don't want to give away too much.
Don't want to give away too much, but that's in the first part of the book, and that's okay. And Bobby Fischer is a fascinating character. Here we have the greatest chess player this country has ever produced, one of the greatest the world has ever produced, first became world champion in his late 20s, and then late in his life, went off the deep end, became anti-Semitic, very powerfully, virulently anti-Semitic, became homophobic, very virulently, became anti-American. There was just a, there was something horrible going on in his head. The seeds for that probably arose pretty early. And exaggerating slightly some of the stories about him, I illustrate, try to illustrate both sides of his personality, but his main role in the book is to get Margot to Bulgaria, which is where the fun begins.
Yeah. If I do the math correctly, I think you may have been around 9 or 10 when the Cuban Missile Crisis actually took place.
Now, give me, don't add too many years to me. I was 8. I turned 8 in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
What do you remember about those days?
My memory is a little confused because sometimes I don't know how much of it I'm remembering and how much of it I learned later. The thing I do remember is people packing their cars. We had a little house in Southwest, and I remember people packing their cars. It was middle of the school year, as they're going on vacation. Some people just left town. I have a very clear memory of that, and that's in the book. I don't remember my parents ever sitting us down and telling us what happened. I do remember, however, a conversation I had with a classmate. I was in third grade by the lockers in my elementary school, in which we were talking about what would happen if a bomb hit Washington. I remember that. I don't think we had any sense of what it meant to have a nuclear explosion, but we had this just a kind of casual conversation, because remember, those were the days we used to have air raid drills, especially in Washington, the first Wednesday of every month. I think it was the first Wednesday at noon, the air raid siren would go off, and all the school kids would, I think at my elementary school, we went into the halls. We didn't have a basement, into the halls, and turned our backs to the window, as that's going to protect us somehow in case something happened. I find that when I talk to younger people today about the Cuban Missile Crisis, it's hard to get them to understand why it was such a crisis, that why people were so scared, that this is a moment that is as close to annihilation as the world has ever come in its history. And had a few decisions been made in slightly different directions, we would have had a war in which at least, at minimum, hundreds of millions of people would have been killed probably in a few days.
Were you old enough at 8 years old to really be terrified the way so many Americans were?
I was not old enough to be terrified because I really didn't understand what was going on. But it's very easy reading the historical accounts to see how much panic there was. A lot of people left the cities. Since the 50s, people have been digging fallout shelters anyway, but some people started digging more fallout shelters in their backyards, especially out in rural areas and so on. It was really quite a remarkable time in our history. And one of the things I try to do in the book, in addition to writing what I hope is a thriller, is to bring that alive.
Do you think that the fact that, as you said, it's the closest we came to annihilation had an influence on why you decided to write about this? And whether it did or not, why a novel when you certainly could have written a nonfiction book about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I teach at Yale a course on the ethics of war, and I do a lot of writing about the subject. And when I teach the ethics of war, we spend a week on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Part of it is trying to get the students to understand why it was a crisis. And the other thing we talk about is what decisions Kennedy could have made differently. And one of the things that I always try to get across to students, and I thought I would try to get across in a novel, is there's an interesting question about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Why did Khrushchev blink and Kennedy didn't blink? Why did the U.S. prevail without a war? And you find a lot of people on the left today who will say, well, it's because we negotiated hard. You find a lot of people on the right who will say, it's because we had our planes in the air and we showed them we were going to attack. But I think the real answer is somewhere in the middle, that what Kennedy did extraordinarily well, and in fact, an important lesson, I think, for negotiators and policymakers today, is to keep Khrushchev guessing. To this day, historians do not know with any certainty whether Kennedy was willing to go to war or not. He kept that card so close to his vest. The reason that Khrushchev blinked, I think, was because in the end, he found the president of the United States too unpredictable. He tried to put the missiles in because he thought he knew how Kennedy would respond. he realized he was wrong, not in the sense that, oh, he will definitely go to war, but in the sense of, I have no idea what he'll do. And that act of keeping off balance is something that is important to convey, I think, about the crisis. And I think that a novel in which Kennedy is a character is a good way to convey it, because one of the things I try to show is the advisors around him thinking he's being indecisive when what he's really doing is trying to hold the reins of this thing, when he's got half his advisors telling him you've got to live with the missiles and the other half saying you've got to bomb them today, and he's trying to hold on to that middle ground tenaciously. We see a lot of that through Margot's eyes, because although she's only 19, she's, in a sense, the only person he can talk to who doesn't have a position on the thing. He's not trying to push him one way or the other. And so ends up talking to her a lot about his thinking.
At one point, fairly early in the book, Margot Jensen is in a position where she has to think about something that someone has just said to her. And here's what she reflects upon. She thought of the old Negro families she knew, some of them with millions in the bank. Few Americans, black or white, were aware of their existence.
Well, we live in a time today when people are accustomed to black professionals, black lawyers, black doctors, black president of the United States, and so on. It's not thought to be unusual, but I would say that most Americans, black and white, think of that as a fairly recent phenomenon, a phenomenon of the last generation or two. In several, not all, but in several of my novels, I've tried to highlight the existence of families that have been professionally successful for many, many generations. There's a family in Massachusetts that built ships for the British in the 18th century, a black family that started as a shipbuilding family. There were black families who fought on the Confederate side in the Civil War because they didn't want to lose their slaves. So it doesn't compute for a lot of people. They can't make any sense of the argument. There are black families that have been professionally successful for a long time in a country that for most of its history has been severely oppressive on the basis of race. And so that the ability of those families to carve out that niche and to succeed against those odds, I think is something to be celebrated. And it's sad that people don't know that history. Again, that history of a handful of families doesn't excuse our larger obligation, given where we are, but it's still an important history to be aware of, that in the face of segregation, in the face of Jim Crow, in the face of racism generally, there are families that have been succeeding for a very, very long time.
You're right. It's contrary to everything we would think about the history of the people in this state.
No, it's true. Georgia actually was an interesting state during the slaveholding era. There are some states, Georgia was one of them, where slaveholding was heavily concentrated in the upper classes. There were other states, Kentucky, for example, where a lot of people of moderate means owned slaves. But Georgia was big plantations with people owning slaves. Most of the working class people didn't own slaves. Georgia and North Carolina both had that in common. There were a lot of working class black families in Georgia at the time of the Civil War. There might have been one or two families that were wealthy enough to own slaves in Georgia, not many. Most of those were in other parts of the South. But it is the case that Georgia in particular, in and around Atlanta, by the late 19th century, in and around Atlanta, you had a number of black professional families growing up and a number of big black businesses founded as well. And that was really quite important because in the days of segregation, of course, a lot of white business people wouldn't do business with black people. And so people look around, they say, well, look, in the black community, you always see these black undertakers, these black doctors and so on. That's because these are services people need. And if the market won't provide them because of prejudice, someone else will provide them. So you had this enormous growth of the black professional class beginning in areas, and insurance was another one, where a lot of white businesses simply wouldn't do business with black people. And Atlanta was one of the big early centers of that. And you had well-to-do black families in Atlanta more than 100 years ago.
There are great twists and turns in this book.
I hope so.
It is very suspenseful. And so if it's okay with you, I'd like to leave back channel, but I'd like to talk a little more about you and your career. You had an opportunity to clerk for two men who were, before they became judges, giants in the civil rights movement. Both of them were deeply involved as attorneys in Brown versus Board of Education. Spotswood Robinson, District Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and then Associate Justice Thurgood Marshall of the U.S. Supreme Court. What did you learn from those two men?
Judge Robinson and Justice Marshall are two of my heroes, and certainly you're right to raise the point because they were two of my mentors, and I did learn a lot from them, and the lessons I learned from them are different with the two men. Justice Marshall, of course, was chief counsel of the NAACP and then the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and he had been involved in lots of cases, and indeed, as part of the point of what I learned from him, this was a man who had litigated cases all over the United States, in the South certainly, but also in the Midwest, and we forget in the Northeast as well, often at great risk to his own life. And one of the things I learned from him that was really quite astonishing, with all the history behind him, with all the things that had been done to him, with all the threats to him and the people he'd known in his life, I never heard him say a bad word, really, about anyone, that he would talk about some of the famous segregationists of the age, of the 40s and 50s, and he used to say, I didn't care what speeches he gave or what he had to say to get elected. I cared, could you do business with him? If you sat down with him in a back room and made a deal, was his word good? That was all that mattered to me. And he would talk a lot about deals that were made in back rooms with people whose political views he and you and I would abhor, but you sat down and met with them anyway because that's what you did in those days. And one of the things that's so appalling about politics today on both sides of the aisle is it seems personal for these people. If I disagree with you, we can't have a meeting. I'd rather go on a talk show and blast you, but I certainly can't sit down and have a chat. And Justice Marshall, I got to know him even better toward the end of his life because I was also the interviewer for his oral history, which we were working on actually when he died. We had spent the previous year, we didn't finish, but spent the previous year working on his oral history. And that was one of the things that became clear is that he had a certain amount of disillusionment. And this is years ago. This is 1991, 92, when we were doing this. But already by then, he was quite disillusioned about American politics and had a sense that people just didn't feel they could sit down with each other and talk anymore and try to reach a deal, and that people didn't keep their word anymore, which appalled him perhaps most of all.
Where are we headed as we lock into our ideologies, refuse to engage with people who disagree with us?
For me, it depends which day you ask me. So I have days when I'm very pessimistic. I have days when I look at the way that people, they tune in the network that agrees with them, they look at the websites that agree with them, they read the newspaper that agrees with them, and so they live in a world of agreement, and that's on the left and the right alike. So I have days when I look at that and I worry. And when people tell me, oh, our politics have always been nasty, that's true. The difference is when our politics were nasty, say, in the 1820s, people did politics maybe 10 days a year, not 365 days a year, and that's a huge difference. On the other hand, with all the problems that we face a lot of problems. We face problems in the economy. We face problems abroad. We face problems of the real challenge of poverty. I still believe that there is an American idea around which people can rally and be optimistic. And part of the American idea is equality. That's not all of it. Part of it is freedom. Part of it is generosity of spirit. And I think it's possible to return to that spirit of generosity in ways that will help us once more take our place as we should, an example of how democracy ought to be run.
Stephen Carter is a professor of law at Yale University. His latest novel, Back Channel, tells the story of the spying and intrigue surrounding the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's all for this week. I hope you'll join me again next Saturday at 4 for another edition of Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Have a great week.